PowerPoint. Okay. So, my name is Hal Poe. I am the Charles Colson Professor of Faith and Culture at Union University, and also the president of the Edgar Allan Poe Museum in Richmond, Virginia. Poe is more of a hobby or an acquired taste or a family obligation. Somehow or another, it fell to me to serve on the museum board to represent the family, and one thing led to another. I began collecting Poe first editions and ephemera about 10 years ago, accidentally, and just sort of accumulated a collection. Only recently, within the last 10 years, became acquainted with Poe's interest in science. Like most people, I did not know that Poe was the one who proposed the Big Bang Theory originally, and that it was a Poe scholar, or perhaps we would say a Poe fanatic named Lemaître, who put it in final form, smoothed out some of the rough edges, and popularized it. But Poe was not just interested in astronomy. When his foster father took him to England for 5 years when he was a child, they brought back a huge telescope, probably the largest one or the finest one that a private individual would own. I think any bigger you would have had an observatory, but it was a huge telescope, and they spent evenings looking at the moon, the planets that could be observed. One of Poe's earliest poems is a sonnet. Later it was named A Sonnet to Science. It was published without a title. Science, true daughter of old time thou art, who alterest all things with thy peering eyes. Why prayest thou thus upon the poet's heart, vulture, whose wings are dull realities? How should he love thee, or how deem thee wise, who wouldst not leave him in his wandering to seek for treasure in the jeweled skies? Albeit he soared with an undaunted wing, hast thou not dragged Diana from her car, and driven the hamadryad from the wood to seek a shelter in some happier star? Hast thou not torn the naiad from her flood, the elfin from the green grass, and from me the summer dream beneath the tamarind tree? Well, as a teenager, he was pondering the idea that science had explained everything, had taken all the mystery away, and there wasn't anything left. But at the same time, he was absolutely fascinated with scientific discovery. He was unwilling to opt for one or the other. And literary scholars have had difficulty pigeonholing Poe. Is he one of the Enlightenment rationalists? And he could give a long essay on the work of constructing a poem. In one of his famous essays is his discussion of how he actually constructed the raven. So there's the rationalist. On the other side, there are the literary scholars who argue he's the romantic. And these were the great literary movements, but he's neither. He was arguing we need American literature, and we don't need to be bound to either. We need a new direction, and why are you picking and choosing? So he was actually more synthetic. Most of us think of him as the horror writer. He hated horror. Absolutely despised it, but it paid. And the reason we remember Poe as the horror writer was because he was just about the only one besides Mary Shelley who could do it well. You've read or at least seen the movie Little Women. You may not know that that was not her only literary work. She wrote those under her own name. She used a pen name to write her horror stories. And that was the main thing she wrote, blood and guts, heads rolling down the street, that sort of thing. That was what the American public wanted. Poe didn't like it. And so finally, he said, I'm going to do something in a new key. You know, the horror story has gratuitous violence at the end and not much plot. He took the gratuitous violence and he put it in the opening scene. And there in an upper story apartment in Paris, two women were found. Their screams were heard by the neighbors. And when the neighbors came to see what was wrong, the door was locked from the inside. And when they broke down the door, there were the bodies, blood everywhere. And the story shifted from being a horror story to asking the question, who done it? And the first mystery is born. Now, I believe that all of Poe's writing, whether his horror, which is supposed to elicit in you a sense of disgust, this is horrible. He doesn't teach a lesson. He assumes that there is a natural order to things and that you are supposed to be disgusted by certain things. This is what C.S. Lewis referred to as the moral law. You are supposed to be disgusted by certain things. And he also wrote the terror story, what Alfred Hitchcock called the tale of suspense. And you are supposed to feel a certain way. And so the tale of terror or suspense is to make you a participant in the story. The mystery story, though, when he invented the mystery story, he's also assuming things about the nature of the universe, the nature of reality. The same when he did not invent the science fiction, but he was the modern model. Jules Verne copied a lot of Poe's stories. But he's assuming enormous things about the nature of the universe, the nature of reality, what kind of universe exists. Let's think about the mystery story for a little bit. It assumes that the universe is rational. There is a rational, ordered universe. See, the problem with horror for Poe was there was no meaning, no purpose, no reason. And so Poe wanted there to be some meaning. And the mystery story assumes an order in which you can understand what's going on. Even if it's insanity, you understand this is the act of an irrational mind in a rational universe. But the mystery story also assumes justice, that there is behind the universe a sense of justice. The reader of the mystery story reads and insists that the truth shall be unveiled, that the right shall be asserted, that the innocent shall be set free, and the wicked punished. There's this, the mystery story only works because there's something behind the universe. And beyond that, we've got a clue as to what kind of something is behind the universe. It's one thing to care if I am unjustly treated or if my family is unjustly treated. We can do a little Darwinian explanation of that, can't we? The mystery story depends upon the reader caring about somebody with whom they have absolutely no connection whatsoever. That's an interesting problem. So Poe was looking at problems of the universe. His big problem was the problem of evil. You know, it's everybody's big problem. Why do the good suffer? That's not the problem. The problem is, why did my wife die? Why did my mother die? Why did bad things happen to me? We don't care quite a bad things happened to them. It's quite a bad things happened to me. His wife died in 1847 after a 5-year bout of tuberculosis. He watched her die a little bit every day. Tuberculosis was a death sentence in the 19th century. He wrote The Raven in the midst of that bout with tuberculosis. The Raven is a poem of anticipatory grief. It was an instant success in the United States and Britain when life expectancy was so low and when every family knew the death of children, husbands, wives. Everyone knew the experience Poe was talking about in The Raven, and that shadow shall be lifted nevermore. She dies in 1847. He takes the year off. Now, much has been said about Poe's poverty. Well, sort of. He was actually doing okay. He had sued someone who had accused him of immorality and drunkenness and all sorts of things like that, and won a sizable ruling from the court. In fact, it was 2 years' salary. So he was able to take the year off, and he devoted himself to what the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy refers to, life, the universe, and everything. And so his little book, Eureka, wherever it went, is an explanation of life, the universe, and everything. You'll see a copy of it in the display case. He calls it a prose poem because he is a poet. And he begins Eureka with a short story set in the future, many centuries in the future, in which two future people are laughing about people back in the 19th century who were disciples of two great thinkers. There was Tottle, who was a Greek, first name Aris Tottle, and then there was Hogg, sometimes called Bacon. And so you also have to remember that Poe wrote more tales of humor like Mark Twain than he did tales of horror, but the anthologies only do The Telltale Heart and maybe The Pit and the Pendulum or Fall of the House of Usher, which he thought, those really aren't my best stories. So he was known as a humorist in his day. So he started off that way. And what he was doing was putting empiricism and rationalism in perspective. And at the beginning of Eureka, he does this. At the beginning of the first mystery story, he does this. And he argues that it is imagination that is the great engine of science and all other knowledge. Dogs are empiricists. I mean, you have to have it, but, you know, that doesn't lead to new knowledge. Not even rationalism. Rationalism is the calculation of things, but it is more or less of the status quo. But it is the imagination that interprets what we observe, and it is the imagination that decides what to calculate. And that the great discoveries are driven by people of imagination. And then he says, now let me explain the universe to you. And he begins by explaining Obler's paradox. Y'all remember Obler's paradox. Why is the night sky dark? Because in a universe with an infinite number of stars, eternal duration, an infinite number of stars, the night sky should be a dull, luminous glow, because every point would be filled with a point of light. And he says, well, that's not what we see. What we see is more like shooting a birdshot against the side of a barn. You have a general distribution of stars, like that birdshot, which suggests that the stars came from a common point. That was his reasoning. But he was imagining the data in a different way. And he goes on and explains his sense of the enormity of the universe. He accepted the nebula theory. He accepted Laplace. He dedicated the book to Humboldt. But he said Laplace really is only giving us a story of locality, a very small neighborhood, our solar system. And the universe is enormous, And he goes on and on for pages talking about how big the universe must be. But with all of that, what he's really getting at is what kind of God exists and what is our relationship to God and what is our relationship to the universe. He anticipates a number of 20th century ideas. He goes on and on talking about attraction and repulsion. The development of repulsion, electricity, must have commenced, of course, with the very earliest particular efforts at unity. What he's suggesting, in contrast to an original unified field, he's suggesting that whatever forces appeared developed after the expansion. He's also got, he's driven by his real agenda. Will I ever see Virginia again? Okay. Charles Darwin, born the same year, has his own agenda. Theodicy is related to it. He's trying to get God off the hook. So, how can a good God have let my daughter die? Well, the good God just isn't as present as we thought he was. Poe's doing it from a different direction. And they're going in different directions. Here's Darwin, who begins with a sort of a fundamentalist, legalistic understanding of creation by fiat. Here's Poe, who's pretty much a not a very religious person. And they pass dealing with the issue of evil, pain, suffering. And Darwin loses his sense of beauty and wonder, loses his sense of how a good God could be involved in all of this. And through it all, Poe gains those things. Remember, he starts off, wonder is gone. And by the end of Eureka, it's there again. And there is God. And it all makes sense because this is a grand story. It's a grand narrative, and it isn't finished yet. The great unity hasn't come yet, and God is involved with all of this. Now, the God he gets from Eureka is sort of a almost a Hindu God. It's almost a we're all a part of God. That's not the end of his story. And I think if you just look at it materialistically, C.S. Lewis argued that Hinduism is probably the most attractive option unless the Bible's true. And he said, if it weren't for the Bible, I'd probably be a Hindu. And what happened to Poe after the publication of Eureka was his then examination of himself. He was a smart person. He was a very smart person. He knew he was a smart person. And he was trying to deal with what we call the Poe family curse through an exertion of the will. My great-great-grandfather, who was his cousin, wrote to him and warned him of the Poe family curse. We can trace alcoholism through our family at least 250 years with documentary evidence. You know, our memory of Uncle Joe and, well, I won't go into all the relatives in the stories, but since time is short, you saw the documents in the case. There's a Sons of Temperance document. Poe went to a Sons of Temperance revival meeting 6 weeks before he died and walked the Sawdust Trail, which would have been a huge humiliation for Poe and for anybody. It's designed to be a humbling experience. And what he came to realize was that what he called in one of his stories the imp of the perverse, and what a lot of his stories reflect, there's something wrong with the human race. It's what the Bible calls sin. But he was observing it. There's a problem with us. And he realized that this God who made the universe is actually interested in him personally. Now, Po for me is an occasion this year to explore the topic of imagination. Imagination is a way of knowing, and it's got flaws. I do Poe as a hobby. I do C.S. Lewis as a hobby. My issue is how the gospel intersects culture, but they are occasions for exploring those themes. This was Lewis's conversion and Poe's conversion are almost one-to-one parallel, except Lewis lived for 30 more years. Poe lived for 6 weeks. So we know a little bit more about the sanctification process. But Lewis addressed this issue of imagination in a number of his letters, and he was exploring what imagination can tell us about possibly how, in fact, God acts upon the human race. That the imagination is a faculty like seeing, hearing, smelling. And like those, it's as fallible as our sensory observations for misinterpretation, misuse. So yes, we do have daydreams, but that tells us we have imaginations. We have psychosis, delusions. But we have invention. And the fact that science exists at all, and that Charlie Towns can sit on a park bench and say, no, we'll have light amplification by stimulation through emissions of radiation. And the imagination is an incredible faculty that I think we as an academy don't pay attention to. It has implications for neuroscience, but it has implications across the field for all of us. And so the main reason I brought this to the ASA this year was to give everybody a moment to relax at the end of 4 days of thinking very hard. But also, I know why you're here. But also to consider imagination as a topic we need to give attention to. How do we stimulate imagination? It's not something we cover, I think, in most of our courses, and yet our disciplines depend upon it. How do you guide it? How do we understand it as a phenomenon? And so I would hope in years to come, different members of this organization will begin to reflect on imagination and perhaps take it up as a point of interest in terms of how it relates to your discipline, because it does, but also how it may be a way of understanding how does God work in history, and what do we mean when we say he spoke to my heart, because that would be the biblical term for imagination. Well, thank you. I'll end there. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain some. Yes. Yes.
For Poe, then, mystery presumes rationality.
Yes.
Can the other be said that rationality presumes, or would it exclude?
No, I think. I think you're absolutely right there, because one of the things that he was recovering was that sense there is still mystery. And, of course, we're using mystery in two different ways, in a sense, the unknowable, that which is beyond us. And one of the things he explores in Eureka is there are bounds. So you've got that kind of mystery that is transcendent mystery. He did not use the term mystery. He used the term ratiocination, which is the combination of rationalism and imagination. Very few people use the term. In 1993, Arthur Peacock used the term in Theology for a Scientific Age. He wrote, "The powers of human ratiocination and conceptual imagination far exceed the demands for survival." In other words, he argued that imagination doesn't quite fit Darwin's theory and is a pointer. I would argue that C.S. Lewis was developing an apologetic based on imagination when he died. And I think such an apologetic can be developed and will be powerful. So that's one thing. But I think it is a perfectly valid and important research area. What in the world is the imagination? Yes.
Just a couple simple questions for you, Al. Just yes or no kind of answers. Part A is, did Poe read Chambers, Robert Chambers' messages? And part B is, the Hindu record is interesting. Did he read letters to Shakulan, the Hindu philosopher, which was written by Benjamin Silliman, the great physician, but anonymously?
I don't know about that. I do know that as the editor of a succession of journals, Poe got free copies of the best books of the day, and that he regularly wrote book reviews on the science of the day, that he critiqued the Bridgewater treatises in one of his essays. And so he was amazingly well-informed about complicated science. He advocated that Smithson's legacy should be used to establish a national college of science that would have that laboratory experience that nobody was getting.
There was a lot of call for that in the early 19th century.
Yeah.
And the fact that America has no national university means that we have state universities all over the place. There was no decision to put up a national university.
Mm-hmm.
The Smithsonian is the closest thing we have even to that.
Yeah.
Was there any, this Poe appeal to Bacon's problem of trying to overcome rationalism and the metaphor of the ant and the spider? The ant and the spirit is here to collect the spider rationally made from cobwebs, whereas the bee translates this into productive imaginative.
Yeah. Well, he went in a different direction from Bacon. He went in a different direction from Descartes, because what he was concerned was the reintegration of the mind-body. He insisted that you've got to bring those back together because they work as sort of a psychosomatic whole. At the beginning of Murders in the Rue Morgue, he discusses the phrenologists and their attempt to locate imagination in one particular part of the brain. And he said, I think they're going to be unsuccessful at that, because he would have seen it more holistically. So he was interested in the relationships rather than the bifurcation. Yes?
In thinking about the imagination and the scientific process, it leads to thinking about the person of the scientists in the church. And I wonder how we might go back and within the local parish find ways to be more caring and deal with spiritual formation for the scientific person.
Well, not just the scientific person, but everybody. I mean, you know, in the evangelical community, we have no room for the arts and literature. We have no place for science. We have no place for almost much of anything. So I think we really are in a crisis in the United States in the evangelical church in terms of nurturing that. Because have you noticed how many people grow up in the church, go off to college, and are confronted with, you know, rather humdrum science? You know, not even monumental things. Science has been around for 100 years. And conclude the Bible is not true, there is no God, Jesus is just a person. And so somehow or another, we have absolutely got to bring this into the local church and help people deal with the relationship between their faith and modern science and understanding the Bible in that context. Well, into your refreshment break, so I'll linger around for anyone who would like to talk more. But thank you so much for your reception and.